the deeds of that person. That's because of my akhlaq. Mm-hmm. I respect you. Hopefully, inshallah, it'll be something that is good for me.
Mm.
You know, standing in a bus, if an old person comes, regardless of that, but we don't know that person, but we stand up, we give them the seat.
Mm-hmm.
Right? That looks good on us. Not to say that we do it for that, but it's something that is beneficial for us. For example, the respect of that particular thing is the first hadith that you mentioned is about husn
ezan.
Yeah. Having, thinking well of others.
Mm.
They have this thing about you. It's to promote
the benefit of the doubt.
But without thinking good about others, that, for example, in the second, how to do tarbiyat, how to train people at different stages of their lives. For example, an elderly man is not going to listen to a youngster, right? That's what they're trying to show here. So there's a way and a method of how you do tarbiyat and development and to teach a person who's older. Like, for example, we have other traditions as well that Imam Ali alayhi salam would always welcome the elder into his home. And he would tell Imam Hassan, you welcome the youngster into our home.
Hmm.
To keep that balance, so to speak, the social balance.
So it's coming back to you, sister. It's a rather a negative thought that sometimes people will grow older, but the experiences don't change them.
Yes.
Why do you think that happened?
You know, maybe there are two groups of people. Some change, as I said, some change their thoughts. Some become more spiritual. And the others are those whose nature stays the same. There are lots of people who are in this way. In fact, these are not exceptions. Lots of people who followed the way of thinking that they used to have as youngsters, as in the middle age, and even when they are aged. And so, as Brother Yasser correctly mentioned, Abi Lahab is a good example of a person who was shaqi from the beginning of his life, and he died shaqi. He died
arrogant.
Accepted that the old people are more spiritual. There are lots of people who are angry when they are young. They give their attention to the outside appearance. There are lots of characteristics that are related to young people. But as they get old, they become more quiet. Those who are angry become more quiet. Mm. Those who give lots of attention to their appearance, they change their mind and say, come on, I just have to be good.
Mm.
And these are the features that I personally believe that as they getting older, as we as people get older and older, come to realize these. And that's a good thing. That's quite appreciable.
Well, there's actually a hadith that you bring to my mind. It's from Imam Ali alayhi salam. Sheikh Yasser, if you can recall, he said that I would rather take advice from an elderly, experienced, wise man than a kind of hot-headed youth,
warrior,
to paraphrase. He used the word warrior?
A soldier, basically.
Soldier, okay.
Someone who's brave. Started the discussion was one of the hadith in my mind. One of the reasons for that hadith is that an old man or an old individual or an old person has a lot of life experience.
Mm.
So you can learn from him. So again, the concept of learning, of seeing that individual in front of you as a means to better yourself, doesn't mean that that person in front of you has bettered himself. That the hadith doesn't say that. There's no indication of it that elderly person is, for example, an awliya of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. The hadith doesn't say that.
Mm.
But what is definite that a person who is elder has had more life experience. That is something that is, you know, definite. It is something that is easily abstracted from the tradition.
Unless he's been in a coma for the first 30 years of
then life. Then that's a different story. Then he's just the same as a child who's just been born. So it is the concept of learning from the life experiences. Another one, it can be this one. Like, if you really think about it, you can learn from the mistakes that that person has made.
Yeah, Imam Ali alayhi salam said, I know history as though I lived it. And he, along those lines, he says, I learned from the mistakes of others to the point where I never committed those same mistakes.
So that's, so this hadith doesn't really point to the fact that that elderly gentleman will have any status, but it's more about learning from their life experiences, the mistakes that this person has made, the journey that he has taken, the wrong turns that that person has taken. Or, for example, the habits that he has gotten that he has never been able to get rid of.
I feel like you are pushing for this idea quite stringently, this idea that, you know, Islam doesn't push us to, you know, willy-nilly just give respect to
Obey.
Why? Do you feel like this is a problem that we do have in the Muslim world?
Of giving respect where respect is not due?
I don't want to use the word respect because you end up respecting everybody anyway, right? But, I mean, this reverence. Reverence should be there for credit's worth, not for age worth.
Exactly.
Do you feel like that's a recurring theme that we feel?
Sometimes, look, our teachings tell us to respect regardless of who the elderly person is, right? So the Islamic teachings tell us that, but it doesn't mean that I respect you because of your age. I respect you, one, because of the teachings I have. That is why I respect it. A person should respect because of the sunnah of the Nabi sallallahu alayhi wa sallam. That's the principle, not age.
Yeah, but do you have like examples in the Muslim world where something's disgruntled you?
No.
I don't want to make you sound like you've got a chip on your shoulder. But
subhanAllah. Not really. It's just that Islam is a very principled religion. It's based on principle. It's not like you mentioned, it's not willy-nilly, for example. For example, the concept of parents, even if the traditions or the teachings of Islam teach us that, the Holy Quran teaches us clearly that even if your parent is not a Muslim, is kafir, you still have to respect them.
You have to be kind to them, you have to.
Not because of their age, not because of anything.
Not obey them, but you have to
respect them.
Right. And again, that's for you, that's not for
nothing
them.
To do. So most of the thing that respected you are giving to an elderly person because of the principle, understand that these principles have a goal, you doing it is taking you towards that goal.
Unfortunately, that's all we have time for today. Sheikh Yasser and from Sister Zainab Sadat, we bid you assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Ya Allah, Ya Rabb al-Alamin, Ya Rahman, Ya Rahim, Ya Rabbi, let the Ummah rise again. يا رب العالمين يا رحمن يا رحيم يا ربي let the ummah rise again let us see daylight again once again.
In the limelight.
Perhaps a full boycott of the UK Book Festival is necessary, says Kit Clanderenberg, journalist, in an article published under the heading UK Book Festival Bows to Israeli Lobby. Stay tuned for more. The head of a major British cultural event has bowed to a smear campaign against Palestine solidarity activists. Opening on June 24th, the Bradford Literature Festival takes place in Northern England city, where many local people have protested against the Zionist regime's crimes. Simia Aslam, the festival's founder, has effectively sought to distance herself from public opinion. In October last year, she took part in an online conference organized by B'nai B'rith, a lobby group, an apologist for Israel's colonization of the West Bank and its attacks on Gaza. Aslam used the occasion to suggest that people moved by the plight of Palestinians have ulterior motives. Her comments accommodated efforts by B'nai B'rith and similar groups to conflate opposition to the Zionist regime's oppression of Palestinians with anti-Jewish bigotry. Although the Zionist regime has erected an apartheid system with support from Britain and the US, Aslam referred to conflicts that are going on, which she claimed can actually become sort of lightning rods for the issues. Aslam did not spell out what issues she meant. Yet her comments were clearly in response to a question about anti-Semitic actions, albeit without examples of such actions being cited. There is a lot that gets vested into, say, the Israel-Palestine conflict, and I don't think the understanding is always there when that is happening, she said, adding, I think a lot of emotions come into that. I am not sure those issues always have to do with that particular conflict itself. Material promoting the Bradford Festival claims it will bring an amazing array of world-class writers to the area. Some of the writers scheduled to appear at the 10-day event are firmly entrenched in the British establishment. Among them are Alistair Campbell, director of press for Tony Blair when he was Britain's prime minister. Campbell, according to the festival program, will be speaking about the big political moments of the past few decades, from Brexit to the pandemic. There is no mention of an arguably bigger political moment, the Anglo-American War against Iraq. That illegal invasion was enabled by an infamous Dodgy dossier that Campbell played a major role in drafting. The dossier contained blatant lies about Iraq's weapons of mass destruction. In truth, those weapons did not exist. Campbell and Blair have never been brought to justice for selling a war based on lies. The sponsors of the Bradford Festival include the Aspen Institute UK. Headquartered in Washington, the Aspen Institute is closely associated with the Crown family. Lester Crown, an industrialist and real estate mogul, is a life trustee of the Institute and father of its current chair, James Crown. The Institute has a formal alliance with the Anti-Defamation League, a leading pro-Israel group in the U.S. Both organizations run a fellowship program ostensibly aimed at nurturing future leaders. Lester Crown, meanwhile, is a broad member of the Jerusalem Foundation, which undertakes construction work in East Al-Quds, where the Zionist regime is actively displacing Palestinians. He's also known to have raised funds for Friends of the IDF, a group that assists the Zionist regime's forces of occupation. Another sponsor of the Bradford Festival is the magazine Jewish Renaissance. David Dangor, the president of the magazine Jewish Renaissance, is a key player in the Exilarch Foundation, supposedly a vehicle for charitable donations. It finances some of Britain's main pro-Israel groups as well, as the Henry Jackson Society, a neoconservative and anti-Muslim think tank, a website promoting the philanthropy of the Dangor family describes David as a strong believer in strengthening UK-Israeli ties, who funds activities aimed at advancing the relationship. The Bradford Literature Festival was approached for comment but had not responded at the time of publication. The festival has been previously embroiled in controversy. In 2018, many Muslim artists withdrew from that year's lineup in protest. The protest was in response to revelations that organizers had received undisclosed funds from the UK Home Office's Building a Stronger Britain Together program, a counter-extremism initiative predominantly targeting Muslims. Just as discriminating against people based on their religion or ethnicity is responsible and reprehensible, Samia Aslam must be challenged over her catering to the pro-Israel lobby, which is dedicated to perpetuating an apartheid system. Perhaps a full boycott of the festival is necessary.
Join us in this journey. IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
U.S. authorities are questioning Americans flying to and coming back from Ukraine. Documents reviewed by Politico show that the U.S. government is gathering information about Americans who are planning to leave the U.S. for Ukraine and are tracking their activities after they return. That only backs up reports that American ultranationalists and white supremacists are moving to Ukraine to join the fight against Russia, alongside those Russia brands as, quote, neo-Nazis.
This is the model that we've seen play out time and time again, going back to Libya and Afghanistan and Iraq and certainly Syria and other places. And of course, we'll see it play out again, because ultimately, in my opinion, what's happening in the Ukraine was made to happen inevitably by U.S. policy. And it's, in effect, another example of a proxy war, in this instance, between the U.S. And Russia.
But it appears that the political optics of the matter is of a secondary concern to U.S. authorities, who see the country's national security at a greater risk. Documents obtained from the U.S. Customs and Border Protection mentioned six unnamed Ukraine-bound Americans questioned at the airport who were either war veterans or had had military training. Two of the six were carrying military equipment. At least three had links to far-right groups. Amid the recent rise in gun violence and mass shootings in the U.S., the country would see deadlier attacks if the perpetrators have the experience of being in an actual war zone. Numerous studies, including those carried out by the U.S. Federal Bureau of Investigation, refer to white supremacists as posing the greatest domestic terrorism threat to the country. The growing number of ethnically and racially charged attacks in the U.S. is raising fears that white supremacists trained in the Ukraine war could conduct even deadlier terrorist operations. Besides, many American citizens have traveled to Ukraine to provide military training to its army and militia, reinforcing the idea that Russian President Vladimir Putin's announcement that his country is fighting to denazify Ukraine isn't far from the truth.
To be sure, we've been seeing all manner of events play out for quite a number of years now, that established beyond any doubt that there are some hardcore extremists taking the fight to ethnic Russians in the eastern provinces of the Ukraine. Thousands and thousands of Russians were killed, and President Putin, in addition to basically taking these moves to secure the boundary that separates Russia and the Ukraine, has stated that it's Russia's purpose to defend those individuals who are of Russian descent in the Donbas and in the Crimean Peninsula.
Russia has singled out the Azov Battalion, among other far-right Ukrainian paramilitaries, to bolster the idea that Nazis are within the ranks of the Ukrainian government and military. The U.S. used to agree with that, at least until as recently as 2018, when it banned the provision of U.S. military aid to the Azov Battalion over its links to neo-Nazis. According to the Washington Post, the Azov Battalion began recruiting far-right ultranationalist and white supremacist foreign fighters the day after Russia attacked Ukraine. The bottom line is, whether or not extremist Americans were sent by the U.S. government to fight the war in Ukraine, they're turning into problems for the country, both at home and abroad.
North Korea has fired 8 short-range ballistic missiles toward the sea off its east coast. South Korea says the missiles were fired from an area of the North Korean capital, Pyongyang. In recent weeks, North Korea has test-fired a range of ballistic missiles, including its largest intercontinental ballistic missile. The latest one comes just a day after South Korea and the United States wrapped up their first combined military drills involving an American aircraft carrier in more than 4 years. Pyongyang has frequently protested against Seoul and Washington's joint military exercises, calling them rehearsals for invasion, despite Washington's talk of diplomacy. The latest test marks the 18th time that North Korea has fired its missiles this year, including what the US says was a failed intercontinental ballistic missile test on May 4th that exploded shortly after launch. Last month, North Korea's leader, Kim Jong-un, said he would strengthen and develop his country's nuclear forces at the highest possible speed. U.S. President Joe Biden's administration has failed to restart diplomatic talks with Pyongyang as tensions escalate. Former U.S. President Donald Trump attempted to court Pyongyang, but even though he met with the North Korean leader three times, he refused to relieve any of the sanctions in return for the several steps taken by Pyongyang toward denuclearization. That hampered further diplomacy between Pyongyang and Washington and prompted Kim to announce an end to a moratorium on the country's missile tests.
So it understands that a country that does not have a formidable arsenal can be subject to US attack because it's considered weak. So this is part of it. Well, if it wants to remain the hermit kingdom, it must look to be strong and unpredictable. And this is how it uses its military, the projection of its military force.
North Korea, which has been under rounds of crushing UN sanctions since 2006 over its nuclear and ballistic missile programs, has ramped up its missile launches this year. The sanctions have led to rising levels of poverty and food insecurity. Despite the acknowledged food insecurity in North Korea, however, the United Nations Humanitarian Response Plan does not include an appeal for assistance to North Korea. A UN World Food Program report in 2019 concluded that 11 million of North Korea's 25 million people were undernourished, and one of every five children were stunted from lack of adequate nutrition. Last month, China and Russia vetoed a US-led push at the United Nations to toughen sanctions on North Korea over its renewed ballistic missile launches. China, the North's closest ally, and Russia, whose relations with the West have sharply deteriorated over its military operation in Ukraine, said they would have preferred a non-binding statement instead of a fresh resolution against Pyongyang. Beijing warned that sanctions would cause an escalation and humanitarian consequences for North Korea, which has been recently hit by COVID outbreak. Meanwhile, Russia said Washington is ignoring Pyongyang's appeals to stop hostile activity. During the past 16 years, the UN Security Council has steadily and unanimously ramped up sanctions to cut off funding for North Korea's nuclear weapons and ballistic missile programs. Since 2017, when the Council last stepped up sanctions on Pyongyang, China and Russia have been trying to ease sanctions on humanitarian grounds.
Because it's a coercive power. It doesn't want to treat another country on equal or humane terms because, I mean, it doesn't want to preserve the current leadership of North Korea. It wants regime change.
In particular, China's strategic overture to North Korea since the collapse of U.S.-North Korea diplomatic talks in 2019 has drawn the two countries closer. With tensions rising over the U.S.-China competition and a new South Korean conservative government that vows to take a harder line on North Korea and China, Beijing has more incentive to keep Pyongyang close. Tehran has blasted the controversial visit by the Director General of the International Atomic Energy Agency to Israel. The IAEA chief, Rafael Grossi, held talks with the Israeli regime's Prime Minister, Naftali Bennett, in Tel Aviv, days after criticism of Iran's peaceful nuclear program. Iran's foreign ministry has warned of further erosion of the agency's credibility, while its Director General kept silent on Israel's secret nuclear arsenal. Ministry spokesman Said Khatibzadeh said this questions the IAEA's impartiality. Grossi's visit to Tel Aviv came in the backdrop of a report by the IAEA alleging that Iran has not clarified the presence of nuclear material at three sites. Khatibzadeh, pointing to the UN nuclear body's blatant double standards, said the world powers cannot overlook Israel's weapons program while indulging in rhetoric about Iran's peaceful atomic program. Israel has never signed up to the non-proliferation treaty that aims to ensure civilian use of nuclear technology. Tel Aviv possesses the largest number of nuclear warheads in the region and has never allowed IAEA inspectors to scrutinize its nuclear sites. On the other hand, Iran, despite being a signatory of the Non-Proliferation Treaty, continues to reel under harsh sanctions for pursuing a peaceful nuclear program. Earlier this week, Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett accused Iran of stealing classified documents from the IAEA and using them to deceive international inspectors nearly two decades ago. Iran rejected the allegations as outright lies. The International Atomic Energy Agency's Board of Governors is scheduled to hold a meeting on Monday, with all eyes on the agency's latest report. The meeting is reportedly set to adopt an anti-Iran resolution drafted by Britain, France, Germany, and the United States to accuse the Islamic Republic of withholding cooperation with the agency. Israel backs the draft resolution to rebuke Iran by the IAEA Board of Governors. Tehran has warned against any unconstructive action at the upcoming meeting of the body, saying it will respond immediately and proportionately.
The right to resist this kind of bullying and coercion and sort of domination from the West, that right to resist is not allowed. You were never allowed to resist. And anything Iran does to preserve its independence is going to be labeled as dangerous and subversive somehow to the international order, and on and on and on.
Iran says the visit by the International Atomic Energy Agency's chief, Rafael Grossi, to Israel ahead of the meeting of the Board of Governors is in contradiction with the agency's principles of observing impartiality and maintaining its technical and professional status. Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian made the remarks in a phone call with the European Union's foreign policy chief, Joseph Borrell, while pointing to the destructive measures of the Zionist regime, which is the main culprit of illegal nuclear activities in the world. Amir Abdollahian censured the, quote, hasty and unconstructive move by the U.S. and the three European countries, namely Britain, France, and Germany, in compiling a draft resolution at the IAEA. He said such behavior goes against diplomacy and will complicate the talks in Vienna to revive the 2015 deal between Iran and the world powers. He reiterated Iran's resolve to reach a good, strong, and lasting deal. Iran's foreign minister also said his country will immediately, effectively, and proportionately respond to any political move against Tehran at the International Atomic Energy Agency. Joseph Borrell, for his part, censured what he called some attempts to undermine the Vienna talks. He urged all the parties involved to continue the dialogue to change the current negative atmosphere pervading the IAEA. The Board of Governors meeting will come as a pause in the marathon negotiations to revive the 2015 Iran deal has entered its third month, with prospects described by Washington as tenuous at best. Tehran blames the U.S. and its three European allies, France, Britain, and Germany, for failing to act constructively.
Tensions are once again rising in northern Syria as Turkey threatens to conduct a major military operation there. Ankara says it wants to establish a 30-kilometer safe zone along the Syrian border and push back terrorists. Turkey has long been fighting members of the People's Protection Units, YPG, a U.S.-backed Kurdish militia it deems a terrorist group. Since 2016, Turkey has carried out three major incursions inside the Syrian territory under the same pretext, the latest of which came in October 2019, which fell short of ending in creating the buffer zone Ankara was hoping for. In the meantime, Damascus has slammed the Turkish plan as an act of aggression and an extension of Ankara's policy of ethnic cleansing in the area.
Turkey has been notorious for smuggling oil and engaging in oil theft in Syria. It has been launching military operations into Syria. It is indeed shot down and killed Russian military members in Syria. So Turkey has ambitions to expand its political footprint and reconquer parts of Syria that it lost after World War I in the Sykes-Picot Act, which the French and the British carved up the Middle East after World War I.
Syria says the measures taken by Turkey have caused civilian casualties and done massive damage to public and private property, including critical infrastructure. Syria describes Turkey's offensive as a shameful act of aggression that has displaced dozens of families from their homes and villages. Russia has urged Turkey to refrain from launching an offensive into northern Syria, saying it could lead to a dangerous deterioration of the already difficult situation. Russia's foreign ministry spokeswoman said such a move would be a direct violation of Syria's sovereignty and territorial integrity. Maria Zakharova added that an incursion by Turkey could cause a further escalation of tensions in Syria. Iran's foreign ministry made a similar statement warning of humanitarian disasters and heightened tensions in the region. Ministry spokesman Said Khatibzadeh said while the Islamic Republic understands Turkey's security concerns, the only way to alleviate those concerns is through dialogue and respect for bilateral agreements with neighbors. Turkey's face-off against the YPG would put Ankara in an uneasy position with the United States, which considers the Kurdish militia a major ally inside Syria. U.S. State Department on Tuesday said Washington condemns any escalation and supports the existing ceasefire lines in the area.
Well, the United States certainly has backed the Kurdish operations to carve up Syria, to carve up Iraq, to basically split, divide, and conquer that whole region into ethnic strife and competition. That is one of the sore points between the U.S. and Turkey is the Kurds, because Turkey sees them as an enemy to be destroyed, whereas the U.S. sees the Kurds as a pawn, as a tool to use in destabilizing Syria, President Bashar Assad, and create endless civil war and conflict there.
Russia, Iran, and Turkey are the guarantors of the Astana peace process and have been mediating peace negotiations between the Syrian government and the opposition since 2017. Any rifts between the three could derail the talks and damage any progress they have achieved.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked
The Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
self-purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamate is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Welcome to another episode of the program Ulema's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by Hojjatul Islam Ali. Stay tuned. May Allah bless the soul of the late Agha Sayyid Mahdi Qawam. He was among the greatest faithful scholars of contemporary Iran. It is narrated that once he gave sermons in the city of Yazd and he was paid 60 tumans as the gift. When back to the city of Tehran, he and his friend went to one of the poor areas of Tehran. Sayyid Mahdi gave his gift of 62 months to his friend and asked him to go to one of the houses in the poor area and give it to them. Sayyid's friend went to the house and gave the pocket of the money to the needy family, and they became very much happy. On their way back home, the late Sayyid Mahdi Qawam told his friend, "Can you lend me 5 tumans to buy somethings for the house?" مؤمن اینه گرفتاری توی مؤمن دیگری میبینه بی خیال نیست این محک ایمانه اگه میخواد آدم This is a true believer. He sacrifices himself for others. Stories like what happened to Sayyid Qawam are the test of faith for the believers. If you want to test your faith, you have to see how much responsible you are towards your brothers and sisters in faith. Especially at the times of hardships, we have to be concerned about the problems of our brothers and sisters in faith. In such situations, Allah will shower His mercy upon us too. Therefore, we as Muslims must not let our relations to be weakened. We must not let Satan destroy our relations in the society. Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of the program Ulema's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Hojjatul Islam Ali. To find out more about this program, log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en, Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
Cultural news, social news, scientific news, artistic news. With delight.
Colombia's long hunt for a fabled Spanish ship, San Jose Galleon, that sank centuries ago, comes to an end. But the mission leads to 2 more nearby shipwrecks filled with treasures.
para poder llegar.
We have found two additional ships, one ship that is from the colonial period and another that, from the point of view of preliminary analysis, corresponds to the Republican period of our history. We also have related vessels, around a dozen similar boats, that will be located by our Navy.
The colonial-era vessels were found near Colombia's Caribbean port of Cartagena. A remotely operated vehicle reached 900 meters beneath to capture the shipwrecks and treasures inside them. San Jose Galleon sank in a deadly battle against English warships in 1708, taking with it billions in treasure. The Colombian president says the findings will be preserved and protected until extraction is done completely. The riches will then be displayed in museums.
China launches three astronauts to its Tiangong space station as its construction enters a critical phase. The three blasted off from a launch center in northwestern China. They are the second group of astronauts to head to the space station since its construction began in April 2021. They will stay there for 6 months. The space station is planned as a three-section structure. The core module was launched in April, and two more components will be sent into space in July and September. The new mission will oversee the integration of the three parts. The crew's commander has described the task as a pivotal battle in the construction of Tiangong, which is planned to be completed by the end of 2022. Colombian scientists managed to reproduce an endangered species of frog, bringing it back from the brink of extinction. The scientists were able to reproduce 29 specimens of Lehman's poison frog after years of investigations and experiments using a lab built specifically for this species. They have released the frogs into the Colombian Pacific region with the hope of starting its repopulation.
We observe how the frogs adapt to this ecosystem, which is theirs, but it is a constant monitoring. And the idea is that of these first 29 frogs at the moment, there are many more little frogs, and now we can tell the world that they are not in danger of extinction.
The scientists, however, warned that this particular species of frog is very difficult to reproduce or maintain under human care. They are also worried about the illegal trade of the frogs, which has already played a key role in pushing the rare species towards extinction. Colombia is home to over 700 frog species, more than any other country in the world except Brazil.
Chinese scientists are establishing a meteorological monitoring station at an altitude of 8,800 meters on Mount Komolangma, the world's highest peak on the China-Nepal border. The 13 members of the research team started the trek towards an 8,300-meter base camp on Mount Komolangma from a 7,028-meter camp on Tuesday morning. They reached the camp in the afternoon and went on the last section of the arduous journey up on Wednesday morning. If the station is established successfully, it will replace the one at an altitude of 8,430 meters set up by the British and U.S. scientists on the mountains in 2019. It will be the world's highest of its kind, according to the Chinese Academy of Sciences.
A bridge too scary for many, but just the right place for those with a head for heights. Vietnam has opened the world's longest glass bottom bridge to the public.
The now recorded longest glass bottom cliffside pathway, and it's spectacular, the engineering required to build that into the side of a cliff but maintain all the features of nature, the greenery, the rock, has been an amazing project, very successful, and I think it will attract a lot of tourists.
The White Dragon suspension bridge fittingly opened with a dragon dance. The structure is longer than the previous record holder in China and has two sections. One stretches over 630 meters between two mountains, while the other runs around a cliffside. Visitors can look straight down at the valley 150 meters below. The structure is safe and made from three layers of 40 millimeter tempered glass. The contemporary ceramics exhibition kicks off at the Villa d'Atres Art Foundation near the French city of Avignon. The exhibit showcases nearly 130 artworks of all sizes. Some are so big they are put on display outdoors. The foundation has created these modern forms from roughly 100 artists from all over the world. The exhibit displays an exceptional diversity of eclectic works presenting sophisticated skills and artistry. Participating artists say working with clay and playing with glazes always produces a unique item that often generates a profoundly universal reaction. The goal of the event is to show how ceramic art has returned to the forefront of the contemporary art scene.
The Light is a bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields, like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
A man in the city of Soran in Iraq's autonomous Kurdistan region has become a local celebrity for a rather peculiar feature on his face. Hussein Abdullah Ahmed is famous for a record-breaking length of his mustache. Ahmed has been going by the name Mr. Mustache for decades now. His mustache has reached the length of 2.4 meters, making him a well-known man in the city he hails from. His son says, however, that his father's unusual feature is nothing new for him.
I've always known my father likes this since I was born. Although there were times when I had seen his mustache short, my dad is famous for his mustache, and we're proud of him.
Ahmed admits his mustache troubles him while working on the farm or trying to sleep, but to avoid the trouble, he either ties it from behind or stuffs it under his clothes. The 73-year-old man is not planning to get rid of his facial hair, which he hasn't trimmed since 1994. He seems to be enjoying the ride of fame as people stop him on the streets to take selfies with him.
The annual Vivid Life Festival has returned to Sydney after being cancelled 2 years in a row due to the coronavirus pandemic. The event kicked off with fireworks and lighting the sails of the Sydney Opera House. Iconic structures like the Sydney Harbour Bridge and the Museum of Contemporary Art Australia are part of a series of new canvases this time around. As an added treat, the 2022 festival also has the longest continuous light walk in the history of the event. Plus, this year's highlights include a choreographed light show by 600 drones. Both residents and tourists have been anticipating the return of the show.
I saw it about 8 years ago, I think, and it's just got better and better, as far as I can tell. I mean, the Opera House is the most amazing canvas possible to project, this just amazing digital artwork. The vibrancy of it, the colour of it, the animation of it, the explosiveness of it, the colour just bursts out in just amazing ways, that the snakes, the chameleons, the lizards crawling across it.
The Harbour City will glow with 50 light installations, the projection artworks, as well as over 100 musical events. Vivid Sydney is an annual festival that lasts for 23 nights, infusing art, innovation and technology while collaborating with boundary-pushing artists. In 2019, the festival attracted millions of attendees. The event is owned and managed by the Tourism and Major Events Agency of the Government of New South Wales. Chilean scientists believe they have found the world's oldest living tree in a lush green forest in the south of the country. The scientists say their study shows an ancient cypress known as the Great Grandfather might have been the record, beaten the record for the world's oldest tree by six centuries. The bristlecone pine tree in eastern California is the current record holder with over 4,800 years of age. The scientist who led the study says the sample they extracted and other dating methods suggest that the Chilean cypress with a 4 meter thick trunk is over 5,000 years old.
We could count all the rings, but we know it's not the tree's age. It's an estimation of what we call a minimum age. So for this kind of tree, the scientific challenge is to estimate with science the part that we do not see and that is missing. And that is what we did with the millennial alerce. This method tells us that 80% of all possible growth trajectories give us an age of this living tree greater than 5,000 years. There's only a 20% chance that the tree is younger.
Borisovich is, however, concerned about visitors harming the tree, which is located in the Costero National Park. He says visitors are still able to circle the tree's base, step on its roots, and even take pieces of its bark. The tree is a conifer native to Chile and Argentina and can grow to heights of up to 45 meters.
Humans have disrupted the turtle survival for years due to their greed for meat, eggs, skin, and shells. But the decreasing population of the species is creating conscious of conservation. Cambodians have released hundreds of turtles of an endangered variety into the wild on World Turtle Day. About 600 Cantor's giant soft-shell turtles were let into a river in northeastern Cambodia. After people collected the species from a holding pool, Cambodian monks blessed the tiny creatures, then set them free. The Wildlife Conservation Society, who was the organizer of this event, it said that only a few records of Cantor turtles have remained in Laos, while they have mostly been wiped out in Vietnam and Thailand. The body has so far released over 1,500 hatchlings into the wild in 2022. The world's oldest living man has just turned 113 years and says he's going to be around at least 10 more years. Good for him. Born on May the 27th, 1909 in Venezuela, Juan Vicente Perez Mora is still in pink of his health and memory and does not take medication. He has no trouble recalling his childhood marriage and the names of his siblings, children, and grandchildren. He has 41 grandchildren, by the way. So what is the secret behind a long life? Work hard, rest on holidays, go to bed early, love for God, and always carry him in your heart. The Guinness World Record has declared Perez Mora the oldest living person last week.
IRIB English Radio.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.